This is kind of the low part, maybe, of my step-parenting. We were decorating the Christmas tree, and she had begged and begged and begged and finally got her own Christmas tree in her room. Mm-hmm. So she's decorating that tree. She was probably nine, not in a good mood. Mm. I finally was fed up. I had it. I just said, you know what? Fine. If you're not going to be part of what we're doing, you can just go to bed. Mm. And I pulled her covers back almost violently to let her get into bed. Mm. And there was a bunch of glass ornaments on her comforter. They shot across the room and hit the wall on the other side. They exploded. I mean, that's a scary moment for a child. And my intentions were to communicate that we want you with us or it's time to go to bed. What came across was, you know, get in line or you're going to be in trouble.
From the Family Life Podcast Network, this is Family Life Blended. I'm Ron Deal. This podcast brings together timeless wisdom and practical help and hope to blended families and those who love them. I know you've had moments as a parent where you thought, boy, I just don't know what to say. I'm stuck here. If I say this, I'm going to hurt one child, but it might be helpful to another child. Have you ever felt that? Like, you're just stuck. Like, what do I do? And if you're in a blended family, then it's, well, my child versus my stepchild. Like, they each have different ears to hear things. So can I say that? Like, is it too soon or should I not go there? Recently, I had a conversation with a friend of mine, Dave Bondeson. He's a stepdad, and he's also a pastor, a children's and family pastor up at Woodlands Church in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And he and I were talking about parenting dilemmas. He has been there. Your dad said something to you throughout your life. It was a question that affected you as a father. What was that?
Yeah, it was less of a question, more of a statement that he just said on a very, very regular basis. Mm. As I was leaving the home, he would always look at me or my brothers. I had two brothers growing up, and he consistently said, Dave, remember, you're a Bondeson and you're a Christian. Mm. Those are the two things that he would say over and over and over again. And in elementary school, that was Dad's talking to me. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then in junior high and high school, it was, oh my goodness, Dad, I've heard this a million times. What does that even mean? I'm a Bondeson and a Christian. But as I think it was when I got into college and I started reflecting on the legacy that my parents left for me and what it means to be, in my context, a Bondeson, what my parents lived out in terms of the character and the humility and the inquisitive nature that they're both scientists, that they would bring to life. But then coupling that with just this deep-seated trust in who God is and what God has done, the redemptive work of Jesus Christ, you are a Christian. That just became so foundational for who I was. It really became this piece that I fell back on and really relied on. And my dad has since passed away, and so he has left a legacy of what it means to be a Bondeson. I still have, to this day, it was almost 10 years ago, I still have to this day, people coming up to me and saying, this is what your dad meant to me in my life.
Oh, wow.
This is what he taught me in a Sunday school class, or this is what he demonstrated as he led a meeting. And so to be a Bondeson, to have that family identity, has been incredibly profound. Mm. And that was one of the hardest things I've had to, and I'm continuing to wrestle through when it comes to parenting in blended family context, because I have this familial legacy that means a lot to me, and it's been tied to my last name.
Hmm.
And suddenly I have someone in my family who loved dearly, raising to the best of my ability with my wife, her biological mom, and she's not a Bondeson in that last name.
Right.
And so it was kind of this tension even growing up of, I always figured that I would tell my kids consistently, you are a Bondeson and a Christian, so that they got annoyed with it. And then later they learned the value of it. And I've had to wrestle with how blended situations change changes that, mm-hmm. what that looks like.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So I'm thinking about this journey for you, and obviously it's very clear that meant something to you. It took on meaning. It gave you a sense of legacy. It gave you a sense of longevity and mm-hmm. generational impact, and I'm a part of that, and I have some responsibility and some maybe some obligation.
Yes. I think the responsibility was huge. It was identity mm-hmm. for me, really. I'm identified with this couple, my mom and my dad, who have lived out these character traits. I'm identified with the body of Christ. Mm-hmm. And that identity has shaped who I am, how I interact with the world. Mm-hmm. As parents, I think it's so important for us to help our kids shape their identity in a biblical manner. Mm-hmm. There are so many, this is such a well-documented reality. There are so many things vying for our kids' identity.
Yeah.
So many confusions about right. even what can define, what can't define their identity. And as parents who are in the business of worldview shaping, in the business, I think we have to be in the business of identity shaping as well. I think one of the helpful ways that I saw modeled in my life was just that repetitive phrasing of, Dave, you're a bondesson and a Christian. You're a bondesson. That was a drumbeat that was beat into my life, and then it was exemplified. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have meant the same thing if my parents didn't live it out, but they did. They gave me that bar. Almost, this is what this looks like.
I want to come back to that identity thing because I think that's really significant. It's a good observation on your part that it's different in blended families, but mm-hmm. we still have to get there somehow. So tell us a little bit about your family. Set the stage for us.
Yeah. So I've been married for 8, going on 9 years. I have one 14-year-old stepdaughter, okay. Layla. She's beautiful. She's unbelievable. I like to make other parents jealous by telling this story. It was a couple of weeks ago now, maybe a couple months ago, where she came up to her mom and I and said, hey guys, I just want to let you get out of the house. I have this $50 gift card for Olive Garden. You go on a date. I'm going to watch the kids.
Wow.
Don't hurry back. Just take your time.
And
it's
then
all
you,
me.
Was this a dream? And then you woke up?
I know. We woke up and it was just a dreary day up in central Wisconsin snowing. That's the type of gal she is. She's just incredibly gracious, incredibly kind. It's been it has not been an easy road for her. So I don't want anyone to think that, parenting in our blended context is simple or easy. Mm-hmm. It's not. There's plenty of bumps. But she is just an incredible young lady. We're excited to see her continue to grow.
Okay, so she's 14.
She's 14, and then I have 3 biological children. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Eden is 7.
Uh-huh.
Ebenezer is 4. And right. then our youngest, Ray, is just about 3. She'll turn 3 fairly soon.
Ebenezer, boy, he's going to curse you when he starts trying to spill his name.
You know, he goes by Evan. He's just a sweet. I try to call him Benny. His mom won't have anything to do with it. But we could not come up with a name for the life of us. And then all of our kids' names have this deep-rooted meaning.
Yeah.
So we like Ebenezer.
So there you are again with identity and meaning and labels.
Yeah.
So even there you're bringing it in as it relates to all the kids.
Right.
So let me just step back a minute into that identity thing that we were talking about. I'm wondering, can you say to the 3 biological children, hey, you're a bondesson and a Christian?
I've really avoided that.
Mm-hmm.
So I have started doing that a little bit more mm-hmm. with our 7-year-old as she gets out of the car, send her to second grade. Remember, mm-hmm. Eden, you're a bondesson and a Christian, because that is her identity. But I think in a blended context, we can be alienating mm-hmm. in the language that we use too. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say anything that might make Layla feel like she's not a part of our family.
Yeah.
And so I've tried to be really intentional. I've had intentional conversations with my wife about how we're going to navigate this.
Mm-hmm.
If bondesson is going to mean something, we have to make sure that it means something for Layla mm-hmm. because she doesn't have that last name.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean she isn't a bondesson. Mm-hmm. And so that's a conversation I've had with her as well. You're gonna hear me. You might hear me say this. This mm-hmm. is why it means something to me. This is why you are a bondesson.
Mm-hmm.
You are part of our family. You are included in this. But I can iterate that as many times as I want. Mm-hmm. And for a junior high or high school daughter who, that's an age where you're going to be wrestling with a lot of identity questions as it is.
Right.
I don't need to fuel that fire. And so I've tried to use phrases like, you're my daughter and a daughter of the king. Mm-hmm. Things that communicate the same idea, identify yourself with us as your parents, identify you with your heavenly father. Mm. But it doesn't carry the same, maybe it doesn't carry the same pithy punch as Bondison and Christian. So.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily connect to the generations that preceded in ways that Bondison does. But I got to commend you on being really careful about this. I, you know, one of the core issues that is going on in nearly every blended family is, where do I fit and how do I belong? It is a question of identity and belonging. And you start off with insiders and outsiders, you know, people who are biologically related. So your wife and Layla, for example, are insiders on day one when you walked in, and you were the outsider. And isn't that interesting that you were a Bondison outsider now stepping in to try to influence, find a relationship with, and then influence insiders? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, to some degree, over time, the gap between insiders and outsiders gets smaller in blended families for most.
Mm-hmm.
Not every relationship. Sometimes you still have one outlying relationship that hasn't quite merged. But with the passage of time, and often it's years, there is this, the gap gets smaller. And yet there's always this sense, it's kind of like with a brother-in-law or a sister-in-law, you know, they're family. But everybody knows they're really technically not family.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, when the will gets passed out and, you know, there's probably a line that gets drawn there just related to blood. And so it is what it is. It doesn't mean we don't love you and include you and you're not, you know, very much a part of our world and our life yet, but we know that there's a difference there.
Those are definitely things to navigate. And I think that's been one of the biggest adjustments for me in blended families is I was raised in the most traditional family you could draw up on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Healthy too, just a remarkably healthy family. And I always assumed that would be my context.
Mm.
And so when my family started and it was not my context, I married a single mom and we walked into life like that, I had to do a lot of adjustments.
Mm.
And it's caused me to continue to do a lot of adjustments even now that we have four and it is this blended context. And so I really had to be open-handed about the insider-outsider feel and really had to identify and put away a lot of assumptions about what family would always be like.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we've seen the, like you said, the insider-outsider mentality shift.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I know that my wife and Layla have a unique relationship that I'm not trying to break into.
Mm.
I'm trying to almost cultivate and encourage. And there are times where it is going to be healthiest for me to say, there is something going on there that I need to let happen and let them get away for a—
Even when you make that decision, and that's an amazing grace-filled decision on your part, even then, do you feel left out a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's something I really have to wrestle with.
Yeah, the outsider thing comes up. There it is.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And there's this almost this tendency I have to kind of put my, you know, tail between my legs and walk away and kind of sulk. But I have to stop and I have to say, why would I ever be disappointed that my daughter and my wife have this unique relationship? And why should I be surprised when they spent the first 6 years of their life virtually bonded at the hip? And my wife, we did premarital counseling with my senior pastor, and he had this weird, wacky requirement that says that we need to get together with him every year afterwards to kind of do marriage checkup.
Okay.
And he always asks me, Dave, what made you fall in love with your wife?
Hmm.
And my answer is always the same. It's one of the primary reasons is I saw how she loved her daughter. I knew the type of mom she was going to be. And that's some insight you get when you're stepping into a blended family that maybe you don't get outside of that. But she sacrificed. She got pregnant at 16. She sacrificed everything for that girl. And I don't want to regret that. I don't want to be disappointed in how she continues to love Layla. And so it has caused me to step back sometimes and feel disappointed, feel hurt. And then I have to say, you know what? This is not something to feel that over. I need to celebrate what God is doing in their relationship.
I think that's a wonderful attitude to have because you can't change it. You know, it's a little interesting to me. A lot of people that I have talked to who find themselves in blended family situations and choose that and so much about it that they love, and then they resent the fact that it's different. Yeah. Well, you know, it is what it is. You know, to embrace it and say, but I got to find my way through. I've got to be okay over here as an outsider for a little bit, because that is a special and unique relationship that they have. By the way, I'm just reflecting back, and I'm noticing that you feeling that outsiderness sensitizes you to Layla feeling that outsiderness back to, I don't want to say Bondison because she's not one. And then that makes her feel like I don't fully embrace her perhaps. And so, you know, yes, there are concerns and fears around this insider-outsider thing. But what I love is that you guys have found a way around that by talking about it, by being open-handed, by finding a different language that still works for her. You know, that you're my daughter and you're still taking ownership and communicating belonging. And I think at the end of the day, that's what matters. The phrase, you're a Bondison and a Christian, worked great for generations because it was 100% true for all people in that situation. It just may have to morph a generation because of the circumstances that you're in. And you found a way to do that.
Hey, I think one of the hardest lessons to learn in blended family is that I'm not going to shoehorn my blended family into a traditional family. I can say as much as I want to say. I can try as much as I want, but it is just not going to be the same context. And the quicker I have learned to open-handedly say, all right, God, then what are you going to do in this context? The quicker I've found peace, and I think that we've been able to move forward.
We were talking earlier about shaping our kids' identity biblically. You know, we've talked a lot about the you're a Bondison side of that equation, but not so much about the you're and a Christian.
Yeah.
And how do we do that? Talk to me about helping to shape our kids and their identity, whether they happen to be biological children or stepchildren.
I'm a big Deuteronomy 6 guy. Talk about these things as you walk and as you lie down, as you walk by the way, as you sit in the gatepost, the doorposts of the city. This concept of we do disciple making with our kids in the nooks and crannies of everyday life. I am a big proponent of ongoing disciple making, not making sure that happens during a certain segment or certain time of day. I'm not a huge family devotion fan. I know some families are incredibly successful in that.
It works for them.
And that's incredible.
Yeah.
Especially in my blended family context, I found that it's very, very hard to do. When we started doing family devotions, trying to do family devotions about 4 years ago, I had a 10-year-old and I had a 3-year-old and I had an infant. And trying to have any sort of conversation that even values scripture in that, you know, some people will say it's not about communicating ideas, it's about communicating values and importance. And we could not do that. It became a fight every single time. And so we've just said that's not the way that we're going to approach this. Instead, I want to make sure that whenever anything comes up that can be incidentally related to Christ, to what Christ is doing, to what Christ is about, I want to lean into that and have those conversations in those moments. And so that's really become my MO as a parent, is that we're eating lunch and my kids mention something and suddenly we're off on a conversation about some level of the Bible or talking about theology. And this happens often. This happens regularly. And I've realized that it is because I'm primed for those conversations. I'm ready for those.
Yeah.
I'm hungry for them. I'm looking for those opportunities. And that's really shaped how I approach those.
Let me just read Deuteronomy 6 for our listener who may not be familiar with it. It's a passage that basically says, look, just talk about things that are important during the natural rhythms of life with your kids. So chapter 6 of Deuteronomy, beginning around verse 4, verse 6, he says, and these commands that I command you today shall be on your heart. So that's first for parents, right?
Right.
We got to live it. We got to own it. It's got to be in us. Then it will ripple out of us for them. You shall teach them diligently to your children, shall talk of them when you sit in the house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be on the frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. So you got signs, you got little symbols, you got little things just that you hang on to in natural rhythms of life as you get up, as you sit down and eat a meal, as you hop in the car and go somewhere, as you're sitting at the soccer game, finding those little moments to just connect faith and life.
Yeah.
That's what really helps communicate godly values over time, and with it, a sense of identity that this is who we are. We are people who live and connect our understanding of God in the world with how we live life.
Yeah. And if I could say two things particularly about that passage. One is that when Moses is saying this, he's saying these things. And what he's talking about is ultimately it's the law of Israel. Mm. It's the law that's been handed down on Mount Sinai that's going to be proclaimed on a regular basis. It's not the things that the parents are finding interesting in Scripture during that day. It's really the institutionalized religion. And so I think for me, this highlights the value of parents making church a priority in their lives. And being in church regularly and then saying what worldview shaping elements am I receiving from the church that I'm putting myself under? How am I going to communicate those things to my kids? So it's not this open-handed, you know, whatever you feel like talking about on a regular basis, start sharing those with your kids. That can get dangerous in a sense. And as a pastor, I get a little defensive about some of those things. But the other thing is what you did mention too is it starts with us. Mm. It starts with us being filled with the knowledge of what God is doing and the work that God is doing and the beauty of the gospel, and it overflows into our kids. So often we talk about parental intentionality as when we get to a moment where we have to choose how to respond, we make a decision to respond in a way that's biblically focused.
Mm.
I've thought about intentionality more in that I'm so filled with the things of God. I'm so passionate about the things of God that when I respond, the natural way that I respond, what is naturally going to come out of me is biblically oriented and biblically directed. The intentionality starts almost even before the response. It starts with what I'm going to fill myself with, not this decision that happens in the moment of response, if that distinction kind of makes sense.
I think it makes sense. What I'm hearing is I'm thinking about my own life, my own walk when I started having children, and what I realized is that I'm not very gentle in my discipline. I'm really pretty harsh in my discipline. That's my natural. So I'm thinking, all right, I got to put on the fruit of the Spirit of gentleness, and that's got to be in me so that when the moment comes, that is who I am when I respond.
Yes.
And I can't just manufacture gentleness in a moment. I mean, maybe you can, you know, but most of the time you won't. And so it really has to be my ongoing discipleship journey that inserts that into my heart and soul and mind so that when something happens with my children, that leads. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, 100%. It's inflow and outflow. Yeah. We have to. We can be intentional as parents about our inflow. But our kids are going to be defined by our outflow, especially by our knee-jerk responses.
So let's run this back through the filter of identity for a minute, because is that easier for you to do with your three biological children than with your stepdaughter? I mean, is there any thought that runs through your mind of, hey, even though this outflow, this response is biblically oriented and centered, it's value-centered, I know my relationship with Layla is different than my relationship with the other three. And does that affect how it comes out of you?
I think that I am more guarded in my responses with Layla.
A little more cautious?
Definitely a little bit more cautious. And it's partially, I mean, you've talked a lot about relational versus positional authority. What authority do you have? And I know that my authority, especially over the first, you know, many years of our relationship, was positional. And I knew that I could lose that more quickly if I respond in a manner that is interpreted poorly.
So just for our listener real quick, positional authority is you're the man of the house, right? So there's a position
there. I'm the stepdad.
Like a teacher in a kid's classroom, they have a position that affords them a certain amount of authority, and children basically respect that. But that doesn't mean they love the teacher. It doesn't mean that Layla loves you. So early on, you were kind of responding out of positional authority. Yeah. And did that evolve and change?
It has. But one of the things that I've had to be guarded about, I think, is that it's not my intentions that will determine how she interprets my actions.
Mm.
And so I can have the best intentions, but if her interpretation of my actions is negative or really, you know, he was so mean in that context, then that's going to affect our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that she gets to steer the ship. That doesn't mean that, like, her perception of everything is definitional. But I have wanted to be very intentional about making sure that I'm guarding myself to not respond in a way that can be very, very, very negatively interpreted. Can I give you an example of
the
time that really
please.
Went poorly for me? This is kind of the low part, maybe, of my step-parenting. We were decorating the Christmas tree, and she had begged and begged and begged and finally got her own Christmas tree in her room. Mm-hmm. So she's decorating that tree. She was probably 9, not in a good mood, not in a good time, whining a lot, yelling, angry. I finally was fed up. I had it. And I'm not a guy who responds really, really strongly.
Mm.
I try to reserve that for moments where I want to make a pretty powerful impact. And this has worked out sometimes. But I just said, you know what? Fine. If you're not going to be part of what we're doing, you can just go to bed.
Mm.
And I pulled her covers back almost violently to let her get into bed.
Mm.
And my intention was to make a bold statement, just said, you're either part of what we're doing right now or you can, you know, be in your room by yourself. There was a bunch of glass ornaments on her comforter that when I pulled it back, they shot across the room and hit the wall on the other side. They exploded. She took a look at those, burst into tears. I mean, that's a scary moment
for
a child. And it came across, my intentions were to communicate that we want you with us or it's time to go to bed. What came across was, you know, get in line or you're going to be in trouble and did not go over well. And honestly, Ron, I spent months recovering as a stepdad from that. That hurt our relationship in such a way, in part because it was a side of me that she hadn't seen. But in part just because of what I communicated through that, it did not go over well.
Yeah, it spoke to her safety with you.
And
it,
Very much.
And it damaged it, sounds like. I like to say it this way. How did you breathe through those months of trying to repair when you knew, gosh, I have really kind of made this difficult?
Two things. One is I intentionally addressed it as often as I could. I certainly made sure that I apologized. I didn't apologize in the height of her emotional response. That wouldn't have communicated to her at all. I let her know that I was sorry, but that wasn't where I sat down and explained to her that I made a mistake. I responded the wrong way. So I made sure that she understood that. But then outside of that, I went forward with the knowledge that I had damaged our relationship, that I needed to be careful in the conversations that we had, that I needed to realize that that instance was going to be a lens through which she viewed our interactions. And so the things I said, the ways that I responded would be viewed through that lens for a time. And that gave me an added level of empathy, an added level of caution in approaching that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, at the end of the day, apology, confession, and forgiveness is what's needed in that situation. And you have to take the lead in humbling yourself and apologizing and talking around it and making it overt and then pressing forward, you know, gently, hoping and praying that she eventually softens and kind of things get restored.
One of the things that I realized in that, too, was that I am not a step-parent in a cultural vacuum, but there's a cultural preconception of what step-parents are.
Oh, really?
And
you mean the wicked stepmother?
You know what? It
happens.
The
abusive stepfather.
A little bit here and there. and that really affected my 10-year-old daughter. And even though I had never shown any signs of any of that.
How did you know that affected her?
She had said things here or there that I thought she was primed to believe that. And suddenly I fell into a stereotype. One action that was outside of the norm, wasn't a mistake. It was a revealing my true colors as the evil step-parent. And so it was helpful to realize that and to navigate that a little bit.
It's so unfair, but it's true. I mean, I hate to say it, but it can only just take one instance, and a child can kind of put you into that category. Mm-hmm. One of the things I say in the book, The Smart Stepdad, for example, is you got to round off your rough edges for this very reason. Like if you just have a quick temper, or you talk loud, or you're a little obnoxious, and people have told you, but you've kind of never really paid attention. You got to watch that stuff, because it can throw you into a category you don't want to be in. And something else relates to this, and that's, I'm thinking of the biological father, Layla's father. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we know about kids who have both a biological dad and a stepdad is that when the bio dad and the stepdad get along well, and the child has a good relationship with both of those men, that they have better outcomes in their life than if they just have a good relationship with their biological dad. Like, it's really important that there is an authentic connection with both men, and that those two guys kind of basically respect each other and are not openly hostile towards one another. The more they get along, even the better that is for the child. It occurred to me as I was thinking about that, that too is an identity issue. I mean, you can't call her a Bondison because she's not, it's a different last name. But then when she goes to her dad's house on occasion, everybody's reminded of who she belongs to in that sense, right? So all of this stuff is tied together. Okay, Dave, so we're talking about leadership and identity and your role as a stepfather, and you're also a biological dad, and there's some distinctives there. Like, it's super easy with your kids. Like, they know exactly who you are, and you know exactly who you are with them. And then there's a little bit of a question mark with Layla. It's a good relationship, definitely gotten better over time, but yet it's not clearly as defined as the others. And you're an intentional dad. You teach people about parenting. You're committed to that topic, and here you are trying to live it out in your own life. And so there's this interesting dilemma between the limits of your role as a stepfather and who you want to be as a leader in the home for the kids. What's good, healthy parenting look like, and how is that maybe different or the same as it relates to you, your role as a stepfather?
Yeah, I appreciated that you said you teach about parenting, and you certainly stayed away from any term like parenting expert or anything like that, because I think the only thing someone who studies parenting knows is that they don't know anything about parenting.
That's right. Somebody who's a parenting expert is selling something.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. The more time you spend, every context is so different.
It is.
And I think that that's probably just one of the important things that everybody needs to hear is that contexts are different. Situations are different. It's not going to look the same.
Right.
I started using a phrase just a couple of weeks ago that I think has been really, really helpful. It's, the things you don't do as a parent are a really poor indicator of the good things that you do do.
Say that again.
Yeah, let me say it a little bit more clearly. The good that you aren't doing as a parent is a poor indicator of the good that you are doing. And it's that as parents, we spend so much time looking at what we're not doing.
Oh, yeah.
You hear your friends are doing family devotions, or you hear someone's going on a family vacation, but they're actually doing a missions trip instead of a vacation. And, these other friends are, they're packing 15 shoeboxes or different things like that. And suddenly you feel like you're failing as a parent. And we tend to judge our effectiveness or our goodness or our worth based off of what we're not doing. Instead of actually looking and taking good inventory of, okay, where am I succeeding? Where am I being intentional? Where am I being faithful in the calling that God has given me at this time and at this place in my parenting journey? And how can I be more gracious in my approach to parenting?
Yeah, wow. You call people to Romans 5 as a source of what good parenting is. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so Romans 5:8 is one of my favorite passages in Scripture, and I think it's one of the most important stepfamily, blended family verses. So it's in the NIV, it's God demonstrates his love for us in this, that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. And the way that I really unpack it is I don't love the translation demonstrates in that verse. God demonstrates his love. The word is actually more proves. And even the original language, that Greek word, It would be used for metals refined. Mm. So it tests the purity of God. God reveals the purity of his love for us in this, that while we were sinners, Christ died for us, that while we rejected his authority, while we walked away from him, while we did everything we could to distance ourselves from identity with God, he sacrificially gave himself up for us.
It's such an amazing thought when you absorb it.
And it's the gospel.
It is.
It's what we should live in, but it's also so prescriptive for parenting. Hmm. It's how are my kids going to know that I love them? How is Layla, my stepdaughter, going to know that I love her? It's while she is doing everything in her power to hold me at arm's length, I'm going to do everything in my power to sacrificially love her. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be consequences for, you know, discipline. It doesn't mean that our relationship isn't going to have its ups and downs and all of those things. But there are so many instances and opportunities that we have to demonstrate this truth and to prove our love. And I look out in the world and I see people at all stages and walks of life still walking in rebellion from God. Mm. And I know that no matter how much of their life they have lived, Christ is still sacrificially giving for them. And so I know that one of the paradigms for my family, my parenting journey, is that I will never stop sacrificially pursuing my children. Now, what that looks like might change based off of decisions they make. And going forward, I don't know. I don't have any guarantee that my kids are going to continually walk with the Lord.
Right.
But I do know that God has given me this charge, and it's to sacrificially love my kids and to prove my love for them. And I'm going to lean into that in every instance I can.
I think that's such a powerful word. And there's just times when that's easier to do than others. There are times. I can tell you, as a dad with two grown boys, there are times when I'm thinking, I don't get you. You know, I like, well, how did you get here?
Yeah.
And where's that coming from? And boy, I wish you would make a different choice. And it, in those moments, you know, it's that, how do I love? How do I communicate that your performance doesn't dictate whether or not I'm here for you? And at the same time, bring some wisdom or encouragement or, you know, a little nudge in a different direction. That, I think, is the powerful combination, but it all starts with love.
Yeah.
If we don't lead there, then the other stuff gets misunderstood and pushes them sometimes in the wrong way.
And there's nothing that's more important as a parent to communicate than love. Hmm. I think sometimes we're afraid, am I going to communicate that I approve of this behavior that I know is wrong, or am I going to communicate that this is the direction you should go when I know you shouldn't? But we can't allow that fear to dictate our response. We need to allow love to dictate those responses. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in this, we need so much wisdom in terms of how to make those decisions. And so even as you were sharing about some of the tensions, maybe with some of the decisions your sons have made, and we all have tensions in those contexts, the need for community, for parenting community, for people that we can just bounce ideas off of, say, hey, this is what's going on in my kids' lives. This is, you know, you've walked with me for years or decades of this parenting.
Yeah.
And this is how I think I should respond. What do you think? We're not going to necessarily have that wisdom in and of ourselves, but we have to have that community.
Let's turn the corner and talk a little bit about the local church.
Yeah.
Again, back to your day job. You're a professional pastor.
9 to 5.
Children and family pastor. And so you've got that lens. And at the same time, you got the stepdad lens. I'm wondering how the stepdad experience has informed your role as a ministry leader, and what kinds of practical things would you share with church leaders about making a difference in the lives of kids and students in churches?
Wow. Well, I started in ministry in a small town in northern Wisconsin where there were not many traditional nuclear families.
Hmm.
And I grew up and was raised in a very traditional nuclear family. And I almost think, Ron, that if I had had that in ministry, got married and then had biological children, I would have missed so many opportunities to minister to people where they were hurting the most.
Mm.
And I would have lost a little bit of a voice because I was a stepdad, because I stepped into that role. that gave me a platform and a voice to speak into some lives where they were hurting the most. Because there is this sense that if you're not a step-parent, it's like, oh, I don't know a step-parent, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And it's not necessarily true, but I think there is a guardedness about it. So it definitely opened my eyes to being cautious moving forward. One of the biggest things that I've realized in ministry, and this is just as a pastor, is I communicate a ton with parents. And the language that I use to communicate with parents in emails, in online, anything, I can either be intentionally inclusive to stepfamilies in that language, or I can ostracize them.
Yep.
And so if I send out an email to hundreds of parents saying, hey, moms and dads, this is what's coming up, right off the bat, I've lost parents. I've not paid attention to stepfamilies. And for a nuclear parent, they would never once think about that. They wouldn't even blink their eye.
Right.
But for a step parent, that might completely change how they perceive my ministry.
And the opposite is also true. They will immediately notice the language that's inclusive, and they will go, he knows that we're here. He is aware of my situation on some level, and he is inviting me in. To me, I call that a bridge of grace. Like, you're saying, look, we're glad you're a part of this church. You don't have to hide your past, your story, if you have any sort of shame around that. It's all good. You know, we're glad that you're here. That little, little thing really communicates a very important message.
Well, and that's the other thing that I think is so important in ministry. There is shame around a lot of the formation of blended families, whether it's divorce, whether it's extramarital pregnancies, whatever was the foundation of the blended family. I think there's a tendency that pastors have and the ministry leaders have to shy away from those situations, to almost close their eyes and to say, I'm going to pretend like this isn't a blended family situation. I'm going to pretend like there wasn't something messy at the beginning of this, and I'm just going to treat these kids like just normal biological kids. But when you do that, it's ostracizing.
Yeah.
Saying your story doesn't matter, or even worse, you shouldn't talk about your story here in the church
because
it's too messy. So I think pastors need to lean into those situations. And there's almost a razor's edge that you have to walk of, we can't be afraid to say, yeah, that was wrong. Wow, that's so hard. That is messy. But at the same time, we need to be brokenhearted about the hurt and the pain and the history in these stories. And so I think for so many pastors, just asking questions, sitting down with step couples and starting to say, tell me your story. Let me know where you came from. Let me know what makes your family tick. Let me hear your story.
Let me
pray with you.
And you're saying when something comes out in that story that is not necessarily God's prescription for relationships or family, we don't have to panic. We don't have to somehow run away from that part of the story. That running away from it sends a shame message that people pick up. You're saying just go ahead and kind of talk through that and acknowledge it, not in a judgmental sort of a way, but it is part of their story.
Right. We can be brokenhearted about the hurt and the pain that has led people to where they are. That's not wrong. But at the same time, we can be filled with grace and love and acceptance for where they are and the hard road that they're walking in right now.
Earlier, I so appreciated you telling the story about your now wife who got pregnant when she was a teenager. And that's part of the story, right? That's how you end up coming into the picture. And I appreciate you sharing that. In a lot of contexts, people will not share that because instantly they feel ashamed, they feel judged, they feel kind of a response, whether it's a nonverbal reaction from somebody. And then they feel marginalized from the church, and we inadvertently push them away from the very thing that could offer them hope and community and encouragement for the future, or the redemptive nature of what church is all about. And so I think it's so important we do that as pastoral leaders or
we shoot ourselves in the foot in terms of being able to reach them or their kids. How about children in particular? Like, are there any structural changes you've made in your ministries? Is there anything you tell your teachers about, you know, complex families to just help sensitize them to the kids they're dealing with or students?
Yeah, we've done a couple of trainings with our volunteers just in terms of working with kids from hard places and what that looks like, and just making sure that Sunday school teachers or small group leaders in our ministry are aware that not every child comes from a context that they might be familiar with, and that those contexts, those messy contexts, those hard contexts will affect how they sit in class, how they perceive what the teacher's saying, how they even listen to teachers and authorities. Blended families, step families aren't as prevalent in the ministry culture that I am in right now necessarily. And so we haven't been as intentional about those programmatic plans as we have in other contexts, as I have in other contexts. But I think that I've definitely approached it more relationally in terms of a ministry context. So less talking to teachers about how to respond to those kids in those situations, and more finding small groups of other stepdads to talk with and to talk through those situations and say, share your experiences.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about community and parenting and sharing and letting other people give feedback and just kind of helping each other out. Has that been, that's part of what you're saying there?
Yeah, I think that it's so important. So I like to think about parents in two different categories, either an are their parent, you are in a parenting context, or been their parent, you have been in a situation. And I divide those by 7 years. So if you've, and that's kind of arbitrary, it's probably influenced a little bit by your book, Smart Stepdad, and just talking about that authority transition. But if you've been in a parenting situation for 7 years, I think that you have some authority or some insight to talk to parents that are in that situation. And so I think it's just so important in our church contexts to get are there and been there step parents together. And so this is weird language, but are there parents might be been there parents too.
Sure.
I've been there as a parent in the step parent with a, you know, an early elementary daughter. I've been there. That was 7 years ago for me. I am there with a teenage stepdaughter.
Yeah.
So I can be talking to stepdads who are just entering into that journey and sharing my experiences, not because they're prescriptive, not because my experiences are going to be their experiences, but because they're descriptive, because I have experienced some of these tensions. I can normalize some of those things for them. I can say, that's totally normal. That might get better. It might not.
But at least I'm with you, brother.
I have some hope for, you know, to offer. And you're going to make it.
Yeah.
You're going to make it through this. But then I also have to be finding parents who are further in that journey for me, which I think is harder, because blended families, while they're certainly not a new thing at all, I've experienced there are less experienced blended family people. There are less people who have been 15, 20 years out of the step-parenting world. And so I'm hungry to find more of those folks in the church, in all of the churches, who can step forward and say, you know what, I'd love to get together with younger step-families, younger blended parents.
The takeaway for our listener that I'm hearing is you can be mentoring somebody, you know, somebody who you're a little bit further down the road than they are. And you probably need to be in community with somebody who's further down the road than you are.
Yep.
It is, I mean, that really helps all of us. And I absolutely would agree with that. That has been a blessing for my wife and I, our entire parenting journey, to have people who are further down the road that we call and go, we're clueless, you know, and what do we do? And that encouragement is so important. But then to be able to come alongside somebody, not that you're saying you're the expert. As you said, you know, it's not that, but it's just about loving and supporting people.
And that's where I think the expert language and sometimes even the mentor language scares people off. I can't be a parenting mentor. Well, you're not asked to be a parenting mentor. You're asked to be an experienced parent. Have you done this before? And can you share what worked in your context? It's a contextualized thing, so it might not work in theirs, but at least it will give them some sense that, oh, people have been where I've been, and they've made it. They've been okay.
You've been listening to my conversation with Dave Bondeson I'm Ron Deal, and this is Family Life Blended. We'll hear a little more from Dave in just a minute, but first I want to talk about this concept of insiders and outsiders. You know, when Dave and I were talking about the Bondison last name and whether he could invite his stepdaughter into being a part of that, really what's embedded in that is a question of how does she belong? You know, Dave is an insider as a Bondison, but his stepdaughter is an outsider. But then it flipped. You remember when we were talking about him trying to get into the relationship with his wife and his stepdaughter? So this time, Dave is an outsider trying to get in with the insiders, his wife and her daughter. You see, when you're in a blended family, you can be in both of those positions at the same time. One minute, you're an insider with people a lot like you and have the same last name. And the next minute, you're an outsider with people who have different last names. Everybody's trying to belong. Everybody's trying to move from out to in. If you've ever experienced that in your life, maybe it was in junior high and you wanted to get into the in crowd, but you know what it is to not be in when they look at you funny and you're not sure you belong and you feel like you're less than. Well, those same kind of feelings can be overwhelming in a blended family situation. The trick is to just not be surprised by those feelings, first of all. It doesn't mean you've done anything wrong. It's just inherent to the process, right? And then go to another insider for help. In this case, Dave went to his wife, and he could say to her, hey, look, what can I do? How can I merge in? How can I respect your relationship with your daughter? But at the same time, what are some ways that I can join that? And then try to be patient with the feeling. Don't panic. I think one of the big mistakes that people make in blended families is they panic when they're an outsider and they feel like this is never, ever going to change. And they give up on the process. And then they start getting angry and frustrated and critical of other people who are insiders. Well, guess what? That just makes the insiders want to keep you out. So that doesn't help. So be patient with the process. Find the little ways that you can join and slowly move in. One last thought. Familyness is not found in a last name. It's found in love and trust. Pursue that, and outsiders will eventually become insiders. Now, before we hear from Dave, if you'd like more information about Dave and his ministry, you'll find it in our show notes. Check it out on the Family Life Blended page at familylife.com/podcasts. We'd like to hear from you. Your feedback means a lot to us. Positive online reviews are really appreciated, so feel free to do that. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcast. Just search Family Life Blended with Ron Deal. And remember to look at the show notes for details, links to additional resources, and learn about our other podcasts on the Family Life Podcast Network. And maybe, if you like what you hear, you'll help us spread the word. Our marketing department is, well, it's you. So think of a couple of friends or family members you could share this podcast with. Maybe post something online on social media. We'd really appreciate it. You're obviously invested in your marriage, so be sure to check out Blended and Blessed, our one-day live stream event. You can join us live in Minneapolis for this event specifically designed for stepfamily couples, or you can join us live on your smartphone or tablet from anywhere in the world for just $19. And churches can host the event for $99. I'll be there, plus a number of guest speakers, including radio personality and pastor Chris Brooks and best-selling author Shanti Feldhahn. And Family Life Today hosts Dave and Ann Wilson are going to be with us as well. This experience, delivered right to you, offers practical help and encouragement for blended families from the leading ministry in stepfamily education, Family Life Blended. I hope you'll join us for this one-of-a-kind event, blendedandblessed.com. Now, here's a final word from Dave.
Step-parenting is not a sprint, it's a marathon, It's a long-term journey. I have said consistently that I want to parent Layla in such a way so that when she's out of the home and she's in a stage of life where maybe she has a little bit more self-reflective ability, she can look back and she can say, Dave loved me. Hmm. Through the ups and through the downs, through my mistakes, through my decisions, through disagreements, Dave loved me. I don't have any sense that a 14-year-old, again, Layla's unbelievable. But sometimes in that 14, you're a teenager. Mm. And so you don't have necessarily the same perception of everything.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not a mature perception.
No.
So what you're saying is, sometimes we don't get along, and sometimes she looks back and says, boy, I wish Dave wouldn't have done that, but I know he loved me throughout it.
Yes. And that's a long-term journey. I want to set her up to be able to realize that. Now, I think that she will. I think she realizes that now. Hmm. And I think that she'll continue to realize that throughout her high school years. But I think more than anything, I want to have that view that when she's 25, when she's 30, that she can look back on the legacy that she has been given. Hmm. And again, that comes out of this identity concept, is that I look back on the legacy my parents gave me. What they modeled, what they demonstrated in junior high and high school, when I was in junior high and high school. And I want to model those same things so that when she's at a more self-reflective age, she can see those. So it is leaning into those moments. And it's also trust. There's a lot of trust mm-hmm. that I have, not necessarily in her, but in God, that God brings these things to fruition. I hold that with an open hand. I know that He does not give parenting promises. He gives parenting directions in scripture. So train up a child in the way that he will go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. That's not a promise.
It's not a guarantee.
No, it's a direction mm-hmm. That we can set our hearts on. And so I'm going to do everything I can to be as faithful in the calling that God has given me. Hmm. I think that chief center in that calling is to love sacrificially.
Yeah.
So not just to love, because it's not God said he, you know, when we were rejecting him, God said he loved us. It's that God proved his love by sending Jesus to die. So sacrificing for us. And so I'm going to do everything I can to faithfully live that out every minute that I can, that my kids are at home. And then I'm going to trust him that he will bring that to fruition in their adult lives.
Now, next time on Family Life Blended, we'll hear from Dave and Ann Wilson. And Dave's going to tell us about, as a kid, the best Christmas he ever had.
Christmas Eve, the whole family went to church. I mean, it's one of these picturesque moments. I can see snow falling, walking in at like the midnight mass type deal. It's probably 10 or 11 o'clock at night. My little brother Craig and I got baptized. That night, the whole family's there. We all come back to the house, and the entire family room is just presents everywhere. More presents than I've ever seen in my life. Why? I didn't know. The next morning, Christmas Day, woke up, Dad was gone.
That's Dave and Ann Wilson, next time on Family Life Blended. I'm Ron Deal. Thanks for listening. And thanks to our legacy partners for making this podcast possible. Family Life Blended is produced by Family Life and is part of the Family Life Podcast Network.